Pennsylvania. Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Delaware River Basin Commission is holding an in-person meeting in Narrowsburg tomorrow where the public can share their concerns and demands about the state of the Delaware River. The meeting even has a special title, Upper Delaware River Day. And Radio Catskill's Maren Scott spoke to Tracy Carluccio from the Delaware Riverkeeper Network for more and what actions Riverkeeper are demanding from the DRBC. The New York-Pennsylvania Joint Interstate Bridge Commission has approved plans for 10 Delaware River crossings, including the Calicoon-Damascus Bridge rehab, starting next month, that will take 3 years to complete. We'll get the details. And dog attacks on mail carriers increased last year. We'll learn what the USPS is doing about it. Plus a special presentation on exploring the relationship between creativity and animal advocacy. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Attorney General Merrick Garland is scheduled to appear before the House Judiciary Committee this hour. Garland is expected to face questions from Republicans about the various prosecutions of former President Donald Trump. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports that includes Trump's convictions on criminal fraud in New York last week.
The attorney general is blasting false claims that the Manhattan district attorney who prosecuted former President Donald Trump was in cahoots with the U.S. Justice Department. Merrick Garland calls that a false conspiracy theory and an attack on the judicial process itself. He says partisans are spreading baseless and extremely dangerous falsehoods about the FBI and singling out prosecutors and agents. Republicans in Congress are threatening to defund the work of Special Counsel Jack Smith, who secured two indictments against Trump. Garland says the Justice Department will not be intimidated, and it will not back down from defending democracy. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
President Biden is expected to sign an executive order today. It could cap the number of migrants allowed across the southern U.S. border once a certain number of people have crossed each day. North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer says he thinks the executive order is going to fail.
I just find it to be, you know, desperate and so transparent as to be worse than ineffective.
But White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre says congressional Republicans have rejected all immigration compromises, so the president needs to take this step.
We are constantly and will continuously look at all options to try and really deal with the immigration system, a system that's been broken for decades.
However, any executive order limiting the number of migrants who can seek asylum in the U.S. is likely to be taken to court. Stocks opened mixed this morning as crude oil prices fell. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 60 points in early trading.
Falling oil prices are weighing on energy company stocks. Retail gasoline prices continue to inch down. AAA finds the average price of regular gas has dropped about 14 cents a gallon in the last month. A survey of U.S. factory managers shows manufacturing activity slowed last month. We'll get survey results from the much larger services side of the economy tomorrow. Toyota has halted production of several car models in Japan and apologized for cheating on crash tests. The company says the bogus test results don't affect the safety of its cars already on the road. And India's stock market slumped today as election results showed a smaller-than-expected victory margin for Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 58 points. The Nasdaq is down nearly 17 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. 25 British World War II veterans are traveling to France today to take part in D-Day commemorations. This week marks 80 years since the Allied landings on the shores of Normandy. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
Bagpipers played on the stern of a ferry pulling out of England's Portsmouth Harbor, escorted by World War II-era gunboats. Alongside them, tugboats in port shot jets of water into the air in tribute. Many of the veterans boarded the ferry with wheelchairs and walking sticks. They're crossing the English Channel to France. The last time many of them made this crossing was
80 years ago. Long time, isn't it?
99-year-old John Dennett served as a Royal Navy anti-aircraft gunner. He says he's going to, quote, honor the lads, end quote, who died next to him on the shores of Normandy in June 1944 in one of the most decisive military campaigns of World War II. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Election officials in India are counting ballots from the country's national election. Voters are choosing the parliament. Initial results suggest Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi will be returned to office for a third time. But it looks like Modi's BJP party will not win a supermajority in parliament. Members may need to form a coalition government with another Indian party. Scientists say that the Kilauea volcano has erupted briefly yesterday on the Big Island of Hawaii. It's in a remote location within a national park. The eruption has paused. There is no current safety threat. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Delaware River Basin Commission is the organization that's in charge of the Delaware River's quality, water quality, and it's central to maintaining and improving the source of drinking water for 14 million people. One of the Delaware River Basin's commission's traditions is to hold an in-person meeting in one of the four watershed states every year. This year, that meeting will be in Narrowsburg, New York, tomorrow, where the public can share their concerns and demands about the state of the Delaware River. The meeting even has a special title, Upper Delaware River Day. Radio Catskills Maren Scotton spoke to Tracy Carluccio from the Delaware Riverkeeper Network for more about this meeting and what actions Riverkeeper is demanding from the DRBC.
So Delaware Riverkeeper Network is an organization founded in 1988, and we work throughout the Delaware River watershed in all four watershed states. So that's New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And we work to defend the Delaware River. And that means defending it from all sorts of degradation or any sort of pollution inputs. And it also means fighting for good protective, preventive regulations and plans in order to make sure that the watershed continues to have the high water quality that it does, particularly in the upper and middle Delaware, which is designated special protection waters because it has exceptional water quality above what is required by the federal government as minimum standards. So we want to make sure that always stays that way, which means that you have to be very careful about the type of approvals that are given for development projects, such as water withdrawals or discharges to the river from various projects. And that would include things like development and also, you know, utilities like a power plant and, you know, all sorts of activities that could have a negative impact on the water quality and the flows of the Delaware River. So we work in a preventive way as well to make sure that that high water quality is protected, because the whole river is affected downstream by what happens upstream. We're always working. We have been doing this as an organization. We have about 28,000 members.
Wow.
And we're, you know, very, very committed to the entire Delaware River watershed. And of course, we love the Upper Delaware. And the fact that the Delaware River Basin Commission is having a meeting in Narrowsburg is a great bonus for us.
Can you talk a little bit about the role that the Delaware River Basin Commission plays and why this meeting is such an important opportunity?
The Delaware River Basin Commission makes decisions every quarter, and they give out permits, or what they call dockets, for water withdrawals and also for discharges to the river. And they review and give approvals as needed for projects that could affect land and water that would then have an impact on the water quality and the flows, on the biodiversity and the healthy habitats of the Delaware River. So they are a interstate agency, quasi-federal agency, because they're made up of the governors of the four states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, and a representative of President Biden. and that is the Army Corps of Engineers. So those five members of the DRBC are going to be coming up to Narrowsburg for a very rare in-person meeting in New York State. And this hasn't happened for several years. And it's one of the reasons we're very excited about it, because once a year since COVID, they only once a year have an in-person meeting. The last one was in Delaware and this is last year. So this one is in New York. And the decisions that they make affect New York all the time. But unless you are following the DRBC or are a member of an organization like our Delaware River Frack Ban and Climate Action Committee that's putting together our action on June 5th, you might not know many of the ways that they affect us.
And what are some of the asks or demands that you guys have for the DRBC, or what are some of the things that you are hoping will come of this public meeting?
At this time, what we've been working on in the last year is advocating that the Delaware River Basin Commission take strong climate action. They have formed an advisory committee on climate change, and we have not seen them take the action that we think that that committee should be taking. It's a brain trust of really excellent experts on climate change, on issues related to watershed planning. And we think that they should be utilized a lot more. As a matter of fact, they should be driving some of the regulatory decisions and planning decisions that are made by the entire DRBC because of the climate crisis. We're facing a climate emergency that is already having impacts in the Delaware River watershed. And we see that through severe storm events and increased flooding. We see it because of excessive heat and unexpected droughts that occur when weather is very unsettled. And that's affecting everything about our environment. It affects everything from agriculture to residential living, quality of life, and it affects all the species that are so important for our region here. All the critters that live in the river, the fish, the wildlife, everything all the way down to special endangered mussels that live in the river, especially in the upper part of the river, that without a healthy river, they wouldn't exist. So climate change threatens all of that because of the changes in the flows of the river, increased destabilization and erosion of streams and stream beds, and then the main stem of the river. And then, of course, because of the increase in fossil fuels, when projects approved emit additional greenhouse, contribute and make worse or exacerbate those climate assessment that should be done for every one of the permits that you approve. You should not approve it if it's going to exacerbate our climate emergency. And you shouldn't allow things that make it worse, such as removing forest. Clear cutting a forest means that you are removing natural carbon capture and you're removing a carbon sink that now works with nature and an ecological system that will be upset when that's cut down. So when you have excessive land development, for instance, or when you put in new impervious surfaces for a highway or a road or something like that, you're going to be cutting down trees, removing natural vegetation, and that in that way, reducing the natural carbon sinks that exist. So we want the DRBC to work with nature. Mm-hmm. We want them to, in the positive light, to prevent climate by making sure that its decisions and planning, such as the flexible flow management plan that they have or the floodplain regulations that they have, reflect the most protective measures for riparian areas that need to be naturally vegetated, uplands that should be forested, and agriculture as well, to make sure that that is sustained in a healthy way. So we're really asking them to change their regulatory structures, put stricter floodplain regulations in place, require an assessment of climate impacts from all the applicants that come to them, and then also through planning and using their really fantastic climate advisory committee, through that those mechanisms, make sure that they put in place precautionary preventive measures that are going to make sure that our environment is protected and that we have a biodiverse and healthy habitats for people as well as non-humans.
And in general, what industries are most of those applications coming from?
A lot of them come from industrial applications. They might come from the middle and upper Delaware. It might be a power plant, a new power plant. It might be gas fired. It might be a new compressor station or a pipeline that goes in as infrastructure for a project that then would release greenhouse gases. Pipelines leak. Methane goes into the atmosphere. Pipelines go in all the time, lower Delaware and the estuary. Those are the kinds of projects that would directly increase greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. And then other applications might be a development application. Large development applications that would take over a certain amount of water have to come to the DRBC. They should be carefully considered because our freshwater resources are diminishing and they're at great risk because of climate change. And that's because of the increase in pollution, but also because we cannot predict drought. We know that the unsettled weather that comes with all the climate emergency impacts that we're experiencing means that we could have a drought come on very quickly. And when that occurs, then all the water withdrawals are going to be continuing if it's for a land development, for instance. And you're going to try to, play catch up by putting in place measures to try to reduce people's use. But you've already got those built in withdrawals. And it's very difficult to manage if you overdevelop in that way.
And do you have an expectation in terms of numbers or how many people you think are going to come out to the public meeting?
Well, we're going to have a press conference at the Narrowsburg Union we're gathering there at 9:15 in the morning. And we'll have different speakers from different issues. One speaker will speak about a plan to develop a recreational development called FIMFO, which is downriver a little ways from Narrowsburg. Another person will be speaking about sustainable agriculture, and how that is threatened by climate change. Another person will be speaking about overdevelopment in the area. And one town that has recently put a moratorium on new development because there's just so much going on, and how new impervious surfaces and removal of natural vegetation is going to exacerbate climate change. So we have that speaker as well. And we have speakers that will be talking about the Climate Advisory Committee and what DRBC should be doing, and also how they should be overseeing all of this in a lot more substantive way than they are and enforcing the regulations that they do have in place. So those, we will have a crowd of maybe 20 people or so, at the press conference. And then we're going to march on over to the DRBC meeting, which will be at 10:30 at the Tustin Theater. So once the meeting begins, they'll be taking actions on just the kind of permits that we're talking about here today. At the end of the meeting, they always have a public comment session. And we have attended everyone in the last 12 years to bring up the hot issues in the Delaware River watershed. And so our Delaware River Frac Ban and Climate Action Coalition will have representatives speaking there in addition to those who spoke at the press conference earlier. Some of them will just be coming out for that meeting and expressing their concerns about how the DRBC could do a better job implementing their advisory committee on climate and making sure that they prevent problems by not allowing the climate crisis to be exacerbated by the decisions they make.
Mm-hmm. And in these past meetings, has the DRBC been receptive to some of the issues you've brought forward?
Yes. I mean, it took 10 years, but we did get fracking banned in the Delaware River watershed. Okay. And that's because everybody fought for it.
Yeah.
And we believe that these changes can be made. They're perfectly in line with the DRBC's mission. There's nothing out of place here. And we do believe that continuing to bring these issues up and giving concrete examples, like at this meeting, of how the climate emergency is emerging in the upper Delaware and the Narrowsburg region is an important way to do that. And we think that way the commissioners will hear us. Mm-hmm. They only meet once a quarter. This is a great opportunity to actually have those commissioners that represent the governors and the president right there before you and have them listen to your examples of how you think they could make changes in order to be able to contribute to tackling the climate crisis instead of, making it worse.
That was Tracy Carluccio of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. The DRBC public meeting is Wednesday, June 5th at 10:30 a.m. in Narrowsburg. In Liberty, I'm Maren Scotton for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, more on the Delaware River, this time getting across it. New York, Pennsylvania Joint Interstate Bridge Commission has approved plans for 10 Delaware River crossings, including the rehabilitation of the Calicoon-Damascus Bridge that starts next month. We'll get details after this break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Thane Peterson, host of Living Jazz. Saturday at noon, I bring you 2 hours of the very best of the current jazz scene, along with a little bit of classic jazz thrown into the mix. It's wonderful music that will warm your heart and soothe your soul. Join me for Living Jazz, noon to 2 Saturday, only on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A nearly $18 million rehabilitation of the Calicoon, New York, Damascus, Pennsylvania Bridge will be getting underway this July. The bridge was built in 1961, and the study of alternatives for the closed 1902 Skinner's Falls, New York, Milanville, PA Bridge is expected to wrap up by the end of the summer. Jason Dole spoke to Lori Ramey, executive director of the Upper Delaware Council, about the plans for 10 Delaware River crossings.
So can I start off by just asking what the UDC's role is in getting this word out about the bridges before we get into the details about the bridges?
Well, there is one opportunity per year when the New York-Pennsylvania Joint Interstate Bridge Commission meets to attend to hear what they have in mind for capital construction projects as well as inspection findings from visiting all 10 bridges that cross the Upper Delaware River and their maintenance plans. So that meeting happened yesterday, May 29th, and it lasts a very brisk 45 minutes or so kind of pro forma about basically approving expenditures and contract schedules. But what we can glean from that particularly are what the most imminent construction projects are coming up and the status of other ones that we've had our eye on.
Just doing the math, Quakey, a 45-minute meeting for 10 bridges with your saying hello and saying goodbye, that's just about 4 minutes per bridge at most.
Right. The departments of transportation for both states get together in advance and work out these construction schedules. So really, this is just a formality to look at the expenditures that are shared jointly between the two states.
So let's start off with the Calicoon-Damascus Bridge, and if you could just remind folks which bridge that is. Is that the big, long bridge that goes over the river from Calicoon?
It is. It was built in 1961, so it's starting to show its age, and because of that, there's a project that's been twice delayed now to do a major rehabilitation of it. It will include everything from addressing a lot of potholes and large cracks in the surface of the deck to replacing sections of the railing that have been damaged by plowing primarily. Also, if you look underneath the bridge, the concrete piers and abutments are in pretty poor condition. There's a lot of exposed and missing reinforcing bars that are evident there. Graffiti has unfortunately occurred. And the approaches for the roadwork on both sides of the bridge need some work as well. So they're going to be addressing all of those issues, the steel members, the joints, the seals, the bearings that require repair and replacement. They also observe that the paint job on the bridge is at the end of its life cycle, so that needs to be taken care of. And they have just in at the end of March, they approved a contract at the cost of $17,859,059 specifically. Let's just say close to $18 million.
Yeah, let's just say $18 million. That works, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
That's big. That's a lot. It's a big job.
It is. And in fact, it's going to take quite a while as a result of it. They estimated that the work will start in early July, but it's going to go through multiple construction seasons up to as long as November of 2027. And one of the reasons for it taking that long is that they do not anticipate closing the bridge entirely at any point. They'll instead have alternating traffic on one lane or the other and switch it over while they're doing this work with traffic signals to control it. And that prolongs the amount of time it takes to do the construction. But generally, to the public, that's preferable to having it take longer than having to resort to detours.
Yeah, and so people can keep an eye out as they approach the bridge and use it for the next 3 or so years. And then other bridges you're taking a look at, the Port Jervis Matamoros Bridge. This is not as big of a project, about $6 million. What's going to be done? When are they going to do it?
That, too, has always been a bit problematic. That's an even older bridge as being built in 1939. But one issue with that bridge has always been that it has an open steel grate deck, and many have observed that when you drive over that, it feels like driving a bike through sand, and that you feel the tires rotating a bit when you're crossing it, and it makes quite a racket as well. There's also some issue about the road salt and other chemicals and harsh substances getting into the river from falling through those open grates. So that one will actually have a deck replacement to now be a concrete deck, as most modern bridges are. And that, of course, takes a lot of money as well. But Congressman Cartwright was able to come up with federal funding to assist in that project. And that, too, is coming up somewhat imminently, that it's going to start, they say, around August and go through spring of 2025. So it's a more compact project, but I can only presume that because of the deck replacement happening, that that one will need to be closed for some length of time.
Yeah, and it sounds like a not dissimilar project from what was done in Narrowsburg a few years back, which used to be like an open grate bridge, and now it's got a deck on it. So, and I guess we should touch on the bridge that most people have been talking about the last few years in our area, which is the Skinner's Falls Milanville Bridge. It sounds like nothing much has really changed. There's no more public comment. When will we know what's actually going on with that bridge?
Yes, that one certainly has been a lingering issue ever since it closed in October of 2019, which is nearly 5 years ago at this point. It's been under study ever since as to what will happen in the future. The alternatives, of course, are remove it entirely and no longer have a crossing there, replace it, which would require tearing down the current historic bridge and putting up a modern concrete structure, or rehabilitate it so that you can preserve the existing bridge, but obviously reinforce it for future life. So there's been a study underway which is called Planning and Environmental Linkages, a PEL study. This is a requirement, particularly because this bridge from 1902 is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. That elevates it to a different level of review where the Federal Highway Administration and the Historic Preservation Offices for both states need to be involved. And it requires a more careful analysis of whether the bridge can be saved or whether there are impediments to that. And as well, the cost factor always has to figure in. So through the Pell study, that's a collection of all the documentation that's been done to date, as well as looking at structurally what can be done, what the feasibility is of retaining the historic elements, and again, the costs associated with each of the alternatives. And it's meant to inform the decision-making process to choose one of those alternatives to bring forward. So the public has been involved by getting updates occasionally on where that all stands. Most recently, as of May 26th, they had a 45-day public comment period where people could sift through the written report that has been released and offer their opinions and their positions. The organization that I work for, the Upper Delaware Council, has steadfastly supported traditional rehabilitation of the bridge because we feel that's so historically and culturally significant to our area that to do anything other than repair it would be a travesty for our communities.
All right. Well, thank you for going over all of that with us, Lori. I know that there's more information, but we're going to have to get going. I will let folks know that all of the info on the bridge projects and construction is up at upperdelawarecouncil.org. It's also on the UDC's Facebook page. I see you posted it there. Before we go, is there anything else you want to let people know quick?
Just that we are always concerned with the aging nature of our bridges, but they're such a special part of our character that we will do anything we can to make sure that they are safeguarded for future generations.
Lori, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Okay, great. And that'll be on...
And that's Jason Dole speaking to Lori Ramey from the Upper Delaware Council. We'll take a break, and when we come back, postal workers don't just have to worry about rain, heat, or gloom of night. Dog attacks against postal workers are on the rise. We'll speak to the USPS about what dog owners can do to ensure safe mail delivery next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Incidents involving dog attacks on Postal Service employees rose to more than 5,800 cases last year. As part of the USPS 2024 National Dog Bite Awareness Campaign this week, the Postal Service is letting dog owners know how they can be good stewards for safe mail delivery. Joining us now is Mark Lawrence from the USPS's Atlantic area, which includes upstate New York and central and western Pennsylvania. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Tim, thanks for having me. Truly appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for being here, and thanks for letting us know about this. I mean, I was surprised about the number of cases that involve dog attacks, and these cases have risen. Huh? Is that the case?
Yeah, you know, in 2022, the number was 5,290 dog bites across the country. And then last year in 2023, it rose to the 5,822 that you had mentioned. So we're trending in the wrong direction here. So we're taking this dog bite awareness campaign this year, you know, and making it more visible and soliciting some help from our customers and your listeners to try to make these deliveries safe and reduce the amounts of dog bites incurred by carriers.
Yeah, dog bites occur almost every day.
And in fact, during this week of awareness, you guys have published a kind of an incident report with U.S. cities with the most dog bite attacks, California and states as well. California saw the greatest number of incidents. But as we think about this, we might think of this happening in a more urban area. This happens in rural areas like ours as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one dog bite is too many. But like you said, you know, the large metropolitan cities are going to have, you know, a lot more bites because they're more populous. Los Angeles, 65 bites, you know, top in the country last year. State of New York last year, 296 dog bites through the whole state of New York. Wow. And don't get me wrong, you know, they do happen locally too. Liberty had 3 bites. Monticello had 1. Port Jervis had a couple of them. So it can happen anywhere. So that's why we just want to ensure that homeowners, dog owners can, you know, have their dogs secure while we deliver the mail and, you know, have those safe measures implemented.
Yeah. You're also letting people know that dog owners could potentially face repercussions. Can you talk about some of the, you know, costs involved with dog bites and, you know, the responsibility of dog owners?
Yeah, you know, we asked the homeowners really, you know, most people have the idea of when their mail arrives every day. So we kindly ask, you know, keep the dog inside the house or, you know, in an enclosed area, fenced in backyard, something like that, that helps keep the path of delivery safe. Every homeowner believes that, you know, hey, my dog's not going to bite. Well, you know, you're the hand that feeds it. I'm the hand that feeds my own dogs as well. I wouldn't think they would bite, but you never know. So it's always best to be safe. So, but if an instance does occur, you know, like you said, Tim, homeowners can be held liable. And the insurance bills for an average dog bite is roughly $65,000. And, you know, homeowners, dog owners could be held liable for some of that money. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like I said, we just kindly ask that, you know, keep the dog inside, you know, in an enclosed room, you know, behind a fence, you know, on a leash, something like that, so they're secure and can't break free.
Yeah. And also, you want to remind pet owners about their children and what they should or should not do when they see the mail coming.
Yeah. Yeah, great point, too. You know, a lot of times it's nice to have your kid, you know, once the mail truck is stopped, approach the mailman and, you know, reach for that mail and hand it to the kid. It's a fun thing. But if you have that pet there, they might take that arm movement towards your child as a threat and, you know, possibly bite the carrier in protection of your child. So we ask that you just, you know, allow the mail carrier to place the mailbox in the mail as normal and be on their way. It just helps reduce one of those instances that can, you know, unfortunately injure the carrier.
And, you know, most letter carriers know that dogs can bite, right? It's part of the job, I guess, even some of those perceived as non-aggressive. The letter carriers are actually trained in this area. Can you talk about some of the training they receive?
Yeah, you know, it's a lot of scanning and getting to know your area. So it is a little bit more troublesome for a new carrier who may be new to the postal service or filling out a route on your normal carrier's, you know, week of vacation that may not be, you know, as apt to know the surroundings. So we message, you know, for the carriers to, you know, scan their surroundings. You know, if they're approaching a residence and are unsure if a dog is there, if they don't see any like leash or dog toys in the yard, you know, jingle the keys, you know, give yourself some time to react before you get to a closer location where your visibility is limited. But, you know, our scanners that the carriers carry can also, you know, send out audio alerts stating that, you know, there's a dog at this property. So it gives them a little bit of heads up. And, you know, there's also means of putting in little reminder cards with the mail that the carrier wouldn't deliver, but just reminds of certain little tricks of the trade or dogs on property to, you know, assist with proper and safe mail delivery.
Yeah, and those little scanners that they carry, there's actually a dog alert feature on those handheld scanners?
Yeah, so if a carrier tells a supervisor that, you know, there's a dog on the property that they have, you know, possibly a concern about or so forth, the supervisor goes into the program and keys in the address, and it allows the handheld scanner to prompt an audio alert as the carrier approaches that property, and that's through GPS technology.
Yeah, that's, I didn't know that. Also, one thing I didn't think about is something, it's a service I signed up for, which is that, informed delivery service, which is, you know, get an email with a digital preview of your incoming mail. And that's kind of for me, because I can't remember anything, but also it's good for folks to anticipate when, for dog owners to anticipate when their carrier will arrive.
Yes. You know, you get a rough time frame window of when your carrier is expected to arrive that day. And that does help. Individuals who work and come home and check their mailbox right away. And, hey, you know, the mail was already delivered. The animal was inside while you were gone. Hey, things are fine. But, you know, you get home from work, open the mailbox. Hey, there's no mail today. Get out, you know, let the dog out. And the next thing you know, the mailman's there in 5 minutes and you got a loose dog. Then there's an issue. So, you know, it's a lot of us working together to get to know the rough time frame of delivery of your mail and, you know, keeping an eye on your dog till you know that mail has been delivered that day.
Yeah, and we're trying to make sure everybody feels safe here, but if a carrier feels unsafe, they could actually, you know, hold the mail.
Yes, yes. We can't put our carriers into a situation they feel is unsafe, so... You know, if there is an issue with the dog, if there's acts of aggression, we will work with the homeowner to try to come to a solution. If there is a loose dog roaming the area that can't be controlled or possibly, you know, the owner of that dog is unknown, mail can be placed on hold for one resident or multiple residents, depending on how far stretched that dog, you know, is wandering. So, and during that time, you know, unfortunately, homeowners would have to go to their local post office to pick up their mail until that situation could be rectified.
All right. Let's remind folks before we go again how they can help ensure safe mail delivery. What are some of the tips that dog owners can do to control their pets?
Yeah. You know, keep your pet inside the house or behind a fence before the mailman gets there. If the dog's inside and you answer the door for the mailman, you know, just tell the mailman you're coming, put the dog in another room, enclosed room, so the dog doesn't charge the door and break out. We know those screen doors are easily, you know, run through by dogs, and also some of those latches, all a dog needs to do is jump up and push down on a lever and, you know, a little bit of weight going forward, that dog's going to push out that door. So put a dog in another room or else, you know, have them on a leash in a backyard on a tether where we know that they have no means of getting to our carrier.
All right. Mark Lawrence from the United States Postal Service Atlantic area, which covers upstate New York and central and western Pennsylvania. More information at USPS.com. Mark, thanks so much for joining us and increasing awareness and keeping everybody safe.
Thanks for having me, Tim. Truly appreciate it.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we're talking about animals, but in a different way. This is a presentation coming up tomorrow exploring the relationship between creativity and animal advocacy. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Chatsko.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, the economist and social critic Glenn Lowry has led a remarkably turbulent life. In a new memoir, he has revealed just about everything.
My affair with my best friend from boyhood's wife. How to make a crack pipe. I know a little bit too much about that.
Confessions of a Black Conservative. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
It's a trip to the jungle this week on the Retro Cocktail Hour when we hear tunes by Shelly Mann for the TV show Daktari and something new by the Swedish exotica band Ixtawela. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7 here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Animal Advocacy and the Arts is an exploration into the symbiotic relationship between creativity and animal advocacy. It's a talk tomorrow at the Poughkeepsie Public Library District Library and spans literature, visual art, and cinema, including works by writers Virginia Woolf and George Orwell, and ethical discussion of films such as Pixar's Finding Nemo, among others. The presenter is filmmaker and composer Kevin Sherwin, and he joins us now. Kevin, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Let's talk about this idea, animal advocacy and the arts, exploring creativity and advocacy for animals. How did you come up with this idea? Where did this idea come from?
Well, I feel like the arts are a really powerful way of bringing people into a new perspective or a new world. It's a powerful way of, you know, creating empathy for a viewer or a listener. It's the reason I made a short film. It's an animal advocacy short film. And I wanted to give some context to the film. So I created this presentation talking more broadly because I noticed, you know, from when I was a kid, a lot of films and books would have animal characters. And one of the ideas behind having those animal characters was to get the viewer to empathize with an animal.
And you mentioned your short film. This short film is called How Do You Milk an Almond? Can you explain to folks about that and how it intersects with this presentation?
Yeah, absolutely. So the short film actually, it tells the story of a fictional lawsuit that's inspired, believe it or not, by real life lawsuits, in particular from 2018. Where an almond milk company was sued in federal court by the dairy industry, a class action lawsuit, for using the word milk to describe their beverages. And I remember reading about this in 2018 and being at once surprised, but also curious. Why are they engaging in this lawsuit? It seems, you know, like there are more important issues to be occupying a courtroom's time. But as I continued to observe, similar lawsuits happen in North America and in Europe, too, not just about milk, but other plant-based foods. I realized it was about something much greater, that the plant-based companies, you know, are new, often startup companies trying to advance plant-based foods, cruelty-free solutions for the marketplace. And these, of course, take market share away from larger corporations. So I realized there was much more at stake in what seemed like a, you know, unexpected trial. I had written a theater song satirizing these events, and eventually wrote a short musical out of it. And then one thing led to the next, and I ended up making a short film, a musical film out of it. And it really was inspired by the similar idea that I was talking about earlier. You know, if you can create an unexpected narrative that connects with a viewer, you know, entertains people, it can get them to think of things in new ways. And we've already had a few screenings of the film. It actually premiered at the Yale Law School back in April, and it's been doing just that. It takes people, you know, into a new perspective for a moment. It makes them laugh, it entertains them, and it educates people about the realities of the commercial dairy industry as well as the efforts of plant-based companies.
Part of the reason why you showed it at Yale is that you're a fellow at the Timothy Dwight College at Yale University. And as I mentioned, yeah, a filmmaker and composer, you have a lot of credits involved with, you know, your compositions, you're performing as a musician. How did this kind of lead you toward this area of creativity and advocacy and animal rights?
Yeah, well, animal advocacy has been part of my life for like the last 5 years, I'd say. I didn't grow up with pets, so it's been something that's part of my adult life, and it's really wonderful. I was actually introduced to animal advocacy through one of my musical mentors, And he's very involved with animal advocacy in the state of Connecticut. And one of the things I'm going to be talking about in the presentation are all the different types of advocacy. It's not just these approaches are not just limited to animal advocacy, but people can learn about one aspect to advocacy is animal rescue. Another is working at the legislative level. Another is working at the product level, such as creating plant-based foods or cruelty-free products. So my musical mentor was involved both on the legislative advocacy level and with animal rescue. And it really inspired me. It really inspired me to learn more. And at the end of the day, the thing that really convinced me was spending time with animals, spending time with both companion animals like dogs and cats who are rescued, but also at farm sanctuaries. These are neglected and abused animals who are rescued and cared for at these farm sanctuaries, and really connecting with these animals and realizing that they needed a voice to speak for them.
Well, animal rights and you mentioned legislation, it seems as if there have been significant changes in improving animal welfare in recent years. Do you feel like enough has been done? And do you feel like through talks like this, you can help folks, you know, get more done?
Yeah, I think it's a continuing effort. It's a continuing effort. There's so many areas. People are not aware of all of the issues at stake, from animal testing to factory farm regulations. The conditions just in those two areas, both in factory farming and animal testing, are still, not what they should be by any extent. And it takes a lot of work on the legislative level to move the laws forward. But in addition to that, you know, as a creative person, as a musician, as a filmmaker, the thing that I think I can do best is create media and create work that influences people's opinions, because that's also really important. Spreading awareness, influencing people's opinions, getting people to see new perspectives, because they work in tandem, really. The more that the public is convinced of something, the easier it is to change laws, the easier it is to enforce those laws. Because at the end of the day, the exploitation of animals is done by individual humans and is enabled by humans. So this is what's, you know, one of the things that's really important.
You know, you've said that the goal of this presentation and the film is to promote compassion for animals in creative ways. I mentioned in the introduction that you're including works by famous people like Virginia Woolf and George Orwell, and you have a discussion of films like Finding Nemo. Can you preview a little bit about how you weave that into the presentation for folks?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so interesting that, you know, many famous writers and filmmakers who themselves weren't necessarily pure animal advocates actually created work that really helps progress these ideas. And I think it's because intuitively they had a love for animals. You know, another famous author that's not included in the presentation is Mark Twain. He is famous for his love of animals. He was anti-animal testing in the late 19th century. But in the case of the writers and creatives for this presentation, you know, one amazing example is a not well-known book by Virginia Woolf, and it's told entirely from the perspective of a dog. And so how could you read an entire book told from the perspective of a dog and not suddenly have an expanded empathy for animals?
And let's remind folks about this presentation tomorrow, where it's happening and where they can get more information.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm really grateful to the Poughkeepsie Public Library. It's going to be tomorrow, June 5th at 6:30 p.m. It's at their Boardman Road Branch Library. They have a wonderful auditorium and projector there, 141 Boardman Road, Poughkeepsie. And the presentation is at 6:30. It'll start with a lecture that I'll be doing And then it'll be followed by a screening of my film, How Do You Milk an Almond?
And where can folks get more information about you and your film?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is howdoyoumilk.com. You can follow us on social media, Instagram. Our handle is howdoyoumilk. As well, my website's kevinsherwin.com, and the Poughkeepsie Public Library also has the listing on their website.
That's Kevin Sherwin, filmmaker and composer, presenting the talk Animal Advocacy and the Arts tomorrow at the Poughkeepsie Public Library. Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Tim.
And that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can find this program and all of our local programs at our website, wjffradio.org. And while you're there, take one small step. One Small Step is powered by StoryCorps, and it's an effort to remind everyone of the humanity in all of us, even those with whom we disagree. It's an initiative that we've partnered with StoryCorps to bring strangers with different political beliefs together for a conversation, not to debate politics, but to get to know each other as people. If you go to the website, wjffradio.org, click on the One Small Step Powered by StoryCorps logo on the right-hand side. It's red. You can't miss it. You can read more about it. You can see examples of One Small Step conversations, and you can apply to be matched for One Small Step. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, the economist and social critic Glenn Lowry has led a remarkably turbulent life. In a new memoir, he has revealed just about everything.
My affair with my best friend from boyhood's wife. How to make a crack pipe. I know a little bit too much about that.
Confessions of a Black Conservative. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation has issued an air quality health advisory for ground-level ozone in the region until 11 o'clock this evening. Air quality levels in outdoor air are predicted to be greater than an air quality index value of 100 for ground-level ozone. The higher the AQI value, the greater the health concern. When pollution levels are elevated, the New York State Department of Health recommends individuals consider limiting strenuous outdoor physical activity to reduce the risk of adverse health effects and people who are sensitive to elevated levels of pollutants, including those who are very young or have pre-existing respiratory problems, such as asthma and heart disease, should use caution. Otherwise, look for a potential afternoon thunder shower with a high of 82, cloudy, low 55 tonight, and tomorrow some more thunderstorms in the afternoon and a high of 80. WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill. It's 11 o'clock.